Okay, so welcome back, everybody. Certainly had a good discussion here. I trust you had likewise in the various other rooms. I suggest we take each subject in turn. We'll get the note taker for the main group to give their 5-minute summary first, and then invite the other groups to add anything, and then we'll open it up, and we'll try and be strict and do 20 minutes per subject. So, should we start off with group one and questions one and two, which is Amy.
So we were talking about topic one, which was the totals, subtotals and potential disclosures, and we were looking at the two questions about the line items and additional disclosures such as net debt reconciliation. So, similar views came out of the two questions, so I'll answer both of them together, I'll get feedback from both of them together. And there were two main views that came out. One was that management should be able to use more judgment to decide which subtotals they want to show, and that they should also be required to show how they got to those subtotals. The other main view was that there should be consistency. And that is, you know, if from one company to another, how are they both getting to the same figure and showing it as the same. And there was also the consistency year on year. What if one year they showed something in a subtotal and the next year they didn't? So there's very much a call for, if management are allowed to use that judgment, then they should show how they have used that judgment. There was also concerns about allowing these subtotals because it's been defined differently. So we're talking about EBIT and earnings. There isn't a definition, so it may not be applied consistently. So there seems to be a balance that needs to be made between allowing this management judgment, but at the same time, this consistency. And that came out in both what subtotal should be presented and in the net debt reconciliation.
I think, just to clarify, I think it's fair to say we were more focused on consistency year by year within the company and not necessarily pushing for consistency of definition across companies. I think we were wanting to have more the management approach to defining, a bit like we do in segment reporting, that we should be allowed to define it how we look at it, and then, you know, other people can judge whether or not it's fully meeting the definition of one industry to another.
Struggle with that a little bit. So we're talking about the primary financial statements, right? So it's, you know, if you're gonna put your foot in the sand or put a line in the sand, you better start at your primary financial statements. And I don't know whether it has to be rigid, but even as a preparer, I'm a little concerned on a lot of flexibility, if you will, on totals and subtotals. First of all, we talk about EBITDA and things like that. It's maybe because our company doesn't do it, I don't have cost appreciation, but that's just excluding things that are expenses. It just is an exclusion. It seems like people can do mathematics if they want to get to that. And I'm not sure what kind of flexibility we're talking about, but it seems like it can get out of control pretty quickly. Like, here's our core earnings versus non-core earnings. It's just based on how the company makes it up. It just seems like you have to, if you're going to stop this out of control thing, the first place you want to do it is in the financial statements report. It's really out of control. I just struggle a little bit.
We open it up. Why don't we use the turn up the cards to speak, as we're doing a pretty large group here. Kevin.
So Malcolm, I think I have some sympathy with what you're saying, but link it into the IFRS 7, where you have to define what management considers capital. And therefore, if you've got effectively debt that might have terms for repayment, but management's policy has always been to just reissue successive debt, therefore it's, in management's view, it's more perpetual. You'd put that in a capital rather than a net debt type operation, or would you be absolutely specific as to this is a liability that will be settled in cash, full stop?
I mean, we didn't particularly cover that point. We did cover the point about, say, pension liabilities or any discounted long-term environmental liability, whatever. Some people might feel that that should be part of debt. Most people, most preparers, I feel, most likely would not put that in debt, but I think it's more important to explain what the net debt definition is. And that's why I think I use the analogy to segment reporting. It's that's also looking at these disclosures, how management looks at it. So if management looks at net debt excluding or including one of these elements, it's a figure that is tickable, and from an audit point of view, it's reconcilable to totals that are shown in the balance sheet and elsewhere. Other people should step in, but as soon as you label something non-GAAP, it's suspicious. And I don't think net debt should be considered to be somehow a suspicious definition. It's totally reconcilable. It's just, as much as segment reporting is. So why should you not be allowed, for example, to put it in your audited financial statements using your definition?
Sayaji?
Thank you. We discussed this issue in the CRAFOR Corporate Reporting Users Forum meeting in Tokyo a couple of weeks ago. And as we are rather consistent country, we have the consistency biases amongst the companies. So the consensus view was that we want to see the operating income, which is most widely used figures, and plus some people use EBITDA. So we want to have the notes which will help us to easily calculate EBITDA. That was the idea subtotals for us at that meeting. And as to the net debt reconciliation, we don't have the custom of using this extensively, so there was not too much strong appetite about this matter.
And Saichi, the operating income, would you like the ISB to define it? Is it flexibility for companies to define it in accordance with their own business model? What's your view?
Well, we would prefer the uniform definition of the operating income. So this is the line, so you make the subtotals here. It would be our preference, rather than this subtotal which go up and down according to the companies.
Given the diversity of income and expense items that different companies have, it might be quite challenging to define the line very precisely.
Yeah, that's right. But if we go into that territory, we cannot define it, to everybody's satisfaction. So you have to define it one way or the other. So I think the uniform definition is, I think, desired from my constituents.
Okay. Jane?
I was a bit puzzled that should legitimise commonly used subtotals such as EBIT. I mean, UK companies have operating profits, sorry to use an old-fashioned word for EBIT, routinely. Fine. I see that in primary statements all the time. So the interesting question is, and I'm agreeing with it, Sage, is whether you try to standardise it. This gets actually back to the much bigger problem, which is that the ISB it's the FS financial statement presentation problem, which is that the ISB has shied away from definitions, over the years. So earnings per share ends up being God knows what. So personally, I think the EBIT is an important number, operating profits. If it could be standardised in some way, that would be good. I fear it would be standardised in a way that, I completely agree it would be in a way that would we would then adjust again. But maybe the starting point would be to sort of discourage some of the non-core adjustments. I also agree about EBITDA. I mean, funny enough, EBIT, really useful number. EBITDA, number to be very suspicious of, for the reasons you said. But actually, lots of companies use it. So let's see it in there. And then let's have the notes about it. So, and the same with net debt reconciliation. Sue's done work on this. Nobody's stopping them from doing it. And we welcome it and encourage it.
Second.
Yeah, just a comment back to concern around out of control. What we try to achieve would be keeping certain communication flexibility to the market. So does that mean that you know, we can freely, you know, allow anything that you know we want, rather, you know, keeping a certain, you know, neoliberal of a definition within the IFL one, and any judgmental things beyond that has to be always reconciled back, so that the definition is very, very clear, so that we can keep a control. And also we can keep a flexibility on judgment, which management want to convey. That's probably, you know, area where we are looking for.
Other comments? Mark, when we were discussing it, you seemed to take quite a different view from Saichi.
I guess my starting position is I like to understand how management think about a business. And so the starting point for me is, if management think of it this way, I'd like it to be disclosed that way. I fully recognise the risk of things getting out of control. The problem is what might be operating for one company might not be operating for another company, and trying to define the operating line, I think, is going to be very, very difficult. If we were to start, for example, at the pre-tax line, probably less debate about that, and we'd be able to pick up all of the items that have been excluded from being out of control in that to the management definition of operating. So as long as we've got good disaggregation of the reconciling items, anybody who wishes to define EBIT will have the information to give them their definition of EBIT, whether it be an aggregator or whoever. So for me, I'm interested in seeing how management wishes to disclose the profit and give me sufficient information to see how aggressive or conservative they've been in the process.
Carlos?
Yeah. We're talking about totals and subtotals, but there are some other measures that I think they are also important. So more companies are talking about like-for-like sales growth. That's usually, you know, impossible to understand what's behind it. And it's probably a more difficult definition than, you know, EBITDA or other measures. So I would include other kind of measurements as part of the discussion.
Lisa?
I think what we are talking about are the two dimensions. What will be stated on the face of the income statement and what will be explained outside the income statement. And I have no problems at all having an EBIT figure on one line in the income statement before interest and before taxes. What I have problems with is, of course, when companies explain earnings in another way in the text. And I also think this is very much an issue for the interim reports. Because if we are talking about definitions, what governs us very much with the interim reports on all levels in the income statement is the collection of analyst estimates. And to use them, we need more reliable definitions on income that, well, we cannot use non-core issues, for instance. We need a solid EBIT figure from the income statement to compare with.
So when you say a solid EBIT figure, the key issue is what is interest? And
yes. Interest income, interest expenses, and to some extent
which bits of interest are there. So there's a whole load of sort of interest type stuff that arises in revenue recognition, leasing, pensions, IAS 37, as well as interest on a bond.
Interest in this respect relates to interest-bearing debt, or what you call net debt. But that is actually net interest-bearing debt, because that correlates to the model that most analysts uses. So we are interested in the net interest-bearing debt, and that correlates to the interest income and the interest expenses that are shown in the income statement.
So should the IASB specify this in the revised IAS 1?
It would be helpful for analysts, I think.
But I have a suspicion that the more we get into it, the more difficult it's going to seem.
Well, if you connect it to the definition of interest-bearing debt, I think it's quite consistent with how analysts treat it.
Okay, so is an interest rate swap part of interest-bearing debt?
If you have a liability that corresponds to the interest cost in the income statement.
And if the hedge is imperfect?
I don't want to go through all the difficulties.
Keep that to myself.
Not also helpful. But as a general rule, this is information that is very important to analysts.
Yeah, I understand. Sue?
Don't think I was first.
Martin.
Yeah, my experience is that the financial results line is contains a lot more sublines than just interest paid and interest received. And it will be very difficult to strike, to create a definition. If there is a definition, I certainly hope the ISB will point it out, but business models differ. You, operating profit for an insurer versus an industrial company, it's going to be very difficult. What do you do with companies that have a financing company and operating and an industrial company? It will be very difficult, and if you then put like, this is how we calculate operating profit, I think there will be lots of companies that will not recognize their own operating profit in that line. So that's the big risk. And if you can overcome that risk, I'm happy with that.
Come back, please.
I just want to ask Martin, don't you want the information anyway? Leave out the EBIT or not? Are you not interested in interest income, interest expenses?
Definitely, I want to have the full detail of how the net financial result is built up, definitely, but that usually is there. You can read it and you can make your own judgment at the moment, whether you make that an operating one or whether you relate it to the capital. But for example, with hedges, it's critical for me to know what part of the hedge results relates to the hedging of the capital basis. Versus what part of the hedge is relating to the operating side of the company. And that's something that's quite difficult to judge at the moment, almost to name something, because you would probably want to distinguish between hedge results towards the operating side versus the capital side. That is probably something you want to distinguish between. Very difficult. So if there is a way to get there, but it will be a long way, I guess.
Yeah.
I think Sue and Maria.
Okay. Sue?
Well, I suppose it's a long-term issue that I wanted to point to. I think we're diving into the long-term aspects of this, which there would be lots of complications and difficulties. But I think there are some things that could be done more short-term, obviously, in light of what you might think about doing long-term, and sometimes short-term fixes are there for a very long time. But, I'd like Malcolm to be able to put his net debt information in the audited financials. It quite well relates. It's drawn from information reported in the financial statements already. Operating profit is not defined. Are we actually saying nobody should be putting a subtotal of operating profit on the income statement? I don't think so. That one seems to be acceptable, whereas EBIT and net debt sometimes doesn't. So I think there may be some short-term changes, some permissibility of really quite commonly subtotals. We're talking about not redefining, but subtotaling some of the elements, so that then they can then be lifted and used elsewhere and described, that operating profit can be easily referred to elsewhere. And I have seen companies that do not put a subtotal, they don't describe it. It'd be kind of helpful if they could describe it as their operating profit and then use that as the reference elsewhere in the financials. I think it would just make the information flow more easily.
I think we certainly feel that there are good short-term improvements that we can make.
From the discussions we had in group one and from what I've heard, it seems to me that the ISB will have quite a hard time trying to define these metrics. So instead of doing so, apparently it would be more feasible to increase the amount of detail that is provided in the financial information, which could maybe be achieved by exploring more the concept of materiality in the discussion paper of the framework. I don't know. That's just a suggestion.
So more disaggregation.
Exploring materiality as something that could also help users calculate these metrics, these indicators, and make that clear, so that preparers have in mind that they have to disclose and detail information sufficiently for them to calculate these metrics.
Okay, Mary last, and then we're going to have the summary of the next group. We can carry on the discussion after that, but we'll...
Mine was a question, so maybe we leave it hanging.
Okay, sure. Should we move on and have the summary of group two, Christy?
So group two, we discussed the question about significant accounting policies, and that was into two sections. What is a significant accounting policy? And then once we decided that, where is the best location of it? In terms, just an overall agreement that we had up front is that both everybody in the group that agreed that accounting policies should not include boilerplate information. And in the sense that you need to be able to understand what company is being you're reading about. It's not a repeat of what's in IFRS. We also made it clear up front that we have to assume that users have a good accounting knowledge of accounting principles, and on that basis we then went on to discuss what might be significant accounting policies. So in that context, Martin had some principles which we worked through and discussed individually. And the first one, the first overall points was that we must know what accounting guidance the company or entity is using, and we also must ensure, or it must be ensured, that we're not disclosing immaterial information. So they're sort of overall principles. But then going through, we said that if what should be disclosed and what should be significant is if there is no choice for the entity not to apply IFRS, that would not be significant. Sorry, I'm mixing my significance and not significant. But if the company has no choice but to apply IFRS, then a description of that accounting policy would not be significant. The second thing, if IFRS allows the entity to have a choice in accounting policy, or there's a change, or there's a new accounting policy, then that would be significant, and you would expect that to be in the significant accounting policies. Also, if it's not evident how or which IFRS the company has applied, then that should be described. So that should be described how and which accounting policies they have applied, or which IFRS they have applied. Also, if it's this, now we're going to get into a bit more of what should and shouldn't be done. If accounting policies should not mirror what's in IFRS, because actually they found that users found that as misinformation in effect, because they have to sort of work out whether it is a true mirror of the IFRS or not. The next point was that any key assumption or estimates should not be, or preferably should not be in the accounting policies, but should actually be described in the notes. And they prefer not to have those discussions in two places. That was sort of the discussion around what is a significant or not significant accounting policy. In terms of location, I think the overriding principles which the users pointed to was that of communication and allowing the entities to have the flexibility to put accounting policies where they a preparer felt would communicate, be the best way of communicating what that policy was. So although I think users had a preference to be able to get access information easily, they would give that up if they felt the preparer had moved an accounting policy to somewhere where it communicated better. So I think overall there was a preference for having the accounting policies with the actual notes, but there was some flexibility between movement. I think there was maybe from the preparer side perspective a bit more sense that this is a paper-based mindset, and they weren't so tied to having location. Location wasn't such a bigger deal, but users, I think, were more inclined to, were more of the paper-based mindset in the sense of it's easier to find the information. In terms of the thing that was people didn't support was the use of a website, neither preparers or users would want to see part of the accounting policy sitting on the website. So I hope that summarises. Please, anybody else in the group, if I've misrepresented anything or forgot something.
Okay. Thanks, Christy. Rob?
What I was struck me was, first of all, that for most of the conversation, it was all sort of, yes, we agree. So that the preparers seemed to want to cut a whole bunch of what they felt is not material information out, and the users were saying, look, if it's not significant, why are you bothering with us? If we don't need you to repeat the standards, we don't need you to describe it, and if you do, you're making our life miserable because then we're trying to figure out whether you've changed something. I think the biggest conversations were really about moving the deck chairs on the Titanic, to use somebody else's comment. There seems to be a big deal about where you're putting it. And yes, absolutely, users, we would like to... I object to the paper-based because actually we're not paper-based, we're spreadsheet-based. It's really what you need to think about it. And, you know, in a spreadsheet refers to a certain cell, and it's better if it's in that cell. We also can use more complicated formulas that go and pick up the information, so I think that's actually a good model. But, you know, the feeling is the way I guess I would describe it is if there's no value moving it, leave it where it is. But if you as a preparer, that there was a clear sense of we want the preparers to have a free hand in communicating. And if the order is causing a problem, then absolutely put it somewhere else. But if it isn't, it's not broken, don't change it. That's about it.
Okay, a lot of agreement. Any other comments?
Can I just... Oh. If, for example, an accounting standard does not have options, like you don't have choices, it's everybody who enters that standard needs to do it in that way. In that sense, in that situation, do you still need a significant accounting policy?
No. No. Even if it is clear for a knowledgeable user which accounting policy applies, and there is no option how to apply it, then it could be a multi-billion dollar amount, but it is irrelevant.
So deferred tax, I think, is a good example. No choices.
Yep.
Can we just delete the deferred tax accounting policy?
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah. Anybody disagree with that, Sue?
Okay. So why do you want to have it in there?
Yeah, yeah. That's what I wanted to drive it. So just to see what happens.
Kevin, you want to jump?
Yeah, you have a choice because, and I'm the preparer, but I think the users need it because they've got to know how I have assessed recoverability of a deferred tax asset.
No, but let's not get into standard specific
policy.
Well, no, I think I'm in the with the judgment.
Yes, it's the accounting policy.
Yeah, the accounting policy. I've got no choice.
Assumptions that yes. you've made is yes. very important to
yes.
us.
Yes.
But if there is no if the policy is if there's one option yes. under IFRS, you can assume that if we don't know what the standard of single option is, we can go read it. That's part of our job.
We don't.
You don't need educators.
Yeah, we don't have an accounting policy.
But Suda, Sue, what?
I'm concerned if we go swashing out too much information, then that judgment that's been made is out of context. Because, and we can sit around this room, and I think the users are fairly knowledgeable, and we wouldn't quote paragraphs to you, but we're quite knowledgeable in terms of what the requirements are. I'm concerned that that's not fully representative of the user community, and there needs to be at least enough to sort of hang the hooks on to understand that context and then the implications for the reported amounts. I don't think we can erase all of it and think, well, they will have read or should go read the IFRS standard. I think there may be a bit of a need for...
Can I just say that, though, in those situations where there is no choice, the significant accounting policy is a summary of the accounting standard. Do you think that summary that they put is enough for somebody to understand the standard? I wouldn't think so.
My
view is that if I compress it 40 pages standard into maybe 5 sentences or 7 sentences, and assuming your thing not everybody is knowledgeable, and the hook they need to latch onto, those 7 sentences, if I can understand, there's no point in writing a 40 pages standard. So I'm a little worried. I'm a little worried.
Let me go over to Bob and then Sandra.
I'm just repeating it. It seems like what came up in our discussion is you got to have a basis, and so what I don't know the exact words, but from what I understand in the concept statements is uses of financial statements will have an understanding of financial reporting, and incumbent in that, if you're going to be a user financial statement, is an understanding of what the rules are. And I see no reason whatsoever to repeat the rules in the footnotes if there's no judgment. It's just a rehearsing, discussion of the words. Well, you can go to the ISB website like anybody else. I don't see any need for them to be in there.
Peter, you want to jump in?
I think we can agree on one thing, and that is that analysts are not normally accounting specialists. I mean, to understand all the accounting policies that a company has just by referring to a single ISB standard, that will scare away even more analysts from doing any kind of accounting job. So if no one really wants to have the accounting policies more in full on the website, I cannot really understand why you want to take away them at all. To me, it's quite obvious that it's better to have them in the summary on the website than take them away because they are disturbing or something.
So here's the problem, and this is a real life. It happened recently. I was actually reading in detail the significant accounting policies, and this was an example, and I won't name the company. They did two things that were really annoying. The first thing is they summarized the policies, and then I had to say, okay, now is that exactly the standard way of doing it, or is there a variation? And it really, I really had to stretch and think about whether this was different. So you cannot describe a standard in a few lines. It's troubling. The second thing they did, which was even more annoying, is they then did a paragraph on the standard, and then they said does not apply. And they had a whole section of this. So I read the first one, doesn't apply. Read the second one, and there were five. And I was very frustrated at the end of this process. I read these summaries, and there was no information in all of this. And I've got to believe that some auditor had beaten them up. What would have been much more appropriate is there are five new standards the IFSB is considering. These are the ones, the names, and by the way, none of them work. And that would have been okay. So
you can always find companies that don't do a proper job.
But I think
it's interesting information. I do this a lot, but I absolutely don't understand all the standards, and I definitely don't know how to dig into this book and trying to find out. I think the summaries that the company presents are valuable to me. I don't need them in the annual report, but if I can have them on the website, definitely I prefer that to have nothing.
I totally disagree and think it's not obvious. And that's part of your job. That's what the basis of what's been said is that you have to have a reasonable understanding of financial reporting. And if you're not going to have a reasonable understanding of financial reporting from a company standpoint, say go to another profession. This is a requirement.
And so why do I have to just repeat this stuff when you can go to a website and look it up somewhere?
For the record, Peter, he's pretty good at what he does, so he shouldn't be going to another profession.
But they didn't put it in the concept statement for nothing. You know, we're in a profession.
When I came up with that, what I was going to say was way before we got into this point, but we were talking about the disclosures, and if you are applying the standard as written, there are still some occasions where you should provide incremental disclosure. You know, revenue recognition was one that we talked about. You know, when does control change? Everybody is going to realize, you know, you're going to recognize revenue when control changes, but there may be a nuance in your industry that should be described on the implementation and how you've applied it in your situation. So, you know, and for the most part, you shouldn't be repeating the standards, but you have to use care in applying that judgment because sometimes you need to provide incremental information or somebody's going to be misled.
Well, what about the poor software analyst that has to analyze U.S. GAAP IFRS and Japanese GAAP financial statements?
I guess it's part of their job, isn't it? So there's not one international gap, so I guess that's a cost of doing business, isn't it?
I've got two of my colleagues that I respect that are saying something slightly different, and they're saying there should be some of this generic information. And I'm against this generic information because I really don't want the company to summarize what the standard is. If I need help on, in essence, what I want is I don't want them to tell me what how the standard is. I'd rather go to a textbook, or I'd rather go to another source. And I think we're hearing this about trying to protect less knowledgeable users. So you disagree with me?
No, I fully agree with you. I'd like to take your comment on. Okay. I think actually, and that was a comment that came into our group. And at the moment, every company in its annual report provides a summary of the same standard. Well, I cannot think of anything more boilerplate than that.
Exactly.
And I think if there is something that the IASB could do, it's basically what you're already doing on some of the standards you're developing, like leases, making a very accessible document and explain in a limited amount of pages how does IFRS treat leases? How does IFRS treat revenue recognition? And I think that should be accessible to investors. And if investors want to know and learn how is revenue recognition according to IFRS, they should be able to go to the website of the IFRS Foundation and find that information accessible. I think there's a role for the ISB here.
Okay, we've been doing that.
I want to move on to the next subject, but Tucker and Malcolm have had their cards up for a while. Let me just do those two, and then we'll have the next summary and then open up the debate again.
Okay. Yeah, nowadays, more and more accounting standards, not just straightforward, but recording judgment estimates. Therefore, I think the real purpose of putting significant accounting policy is not just summary of accounting standard, but as people say, sharing what the judgment estimate that the company is making, so that reader will understand what our intention is. So I think putting those judgment estimates and also range of the impact, potential impact based upon the assumptions, I think that's very important that the company should communicate, and then also reader should understand.
Okay.
I just want to make the same point a bit. And I think we should, it's more entity-specific points, and I think in any standard, even deferred tax, some companies might have a view about deferred tax on distribution of retained earnings in foreign subsidiaries or something. Others might have a different treatment. So, I think you should emphasize that the company should really focus on what's entity specific, how they've interpreted the policy, and what are the key assumptions, more than boilerplate regurgitation of text that's in the book.
Okay, can we go to the next summary? And Marilla and Sue, will come back to you after that.
So our group talked about the topic three, the detailed disclosure requirements versus the objective. And we started off with a general discussion about one of the preparers noted that they've already started giving information in their notes of what management has concluded is material. So what have they included and excluded in their notes? And they said this has worked quite well for them, and this has not been come up as an issue by the users of their financial statements or the regulators. Another comment about that was made about that there might not be an issue come up until there is a problem, but there was an interesting discussion around that already existing for some companies having made that decision. And another item that was brought up in general was the definition or the proposed definition of materiality, and we did have some users that liked the idea of materiality being what would move the share price, but then there was the concern about who people might have different objectives or different views of what might move the share price, so there was still some discretion there. We also, the point was also brought up that sometimes if an item is immaterial, that is also important information for an investor. So, for example, if stock compensation is very small or if the executives are not paid a lot of money, the investor or the user or the analyst might actually want that information. And so we had a discussion as well about whether we could have a disconnect between materiality or significant items in the face of the financial statements versus the note disclosure. So could you have an immaterial item in your financial statements but need for disclosure, or vice versa, could you have a material item to your financials but actually something that users don't think is as necessary to have information about, such as, say, PP&E for a bank, property, plant, equipment for a bank. So we had that discussion as well. And then we started talking about what the question, so which examples, which possible approaches did we think worked? And overall, there was consensus that the A, so basically provide a disclosure objective only, wouldn't work. So we needed to have more, we couldn't just have a free-for-all. There needed to be more structure around the requirements. There was some discussion about whether we could have B and as a list of just possible disclosures, but combine that with the objective of disclosures in D and E. There was also a discussion of whether C would work, so C is the extended list with some overlap, but there was concern that even though this is a nice idea, maybe because it would allow judgment, maybe it would lead to a longer list. So there wasn't necessarily agreement on C. There was a lot of discussion about having E included with D, and if you had with E, this last one, this last idea, you could exclude the first little I, because the idea was that D would cover what the concept of materiality was. So if you did a combination of D and E without the little I, that might meet objectives. But if you did that, there was a concern that we needed to clarify, be a little bit clearer about the level of disaggregation or aggregation that was needed for users.
So D1 and 2 plus E 2 to 5.
Yes, D1 or D2 plus E 2 to 5.
And that was consensus?
I think there was general agreement. I mean, I'm happy to be corrected after this summary. We didn't have necessarily a consensus on any one of these other than A shouldn't be used. So we had general discussion about the interaction of the different ones and whether they should be standard specific or they should be, you know, the general objective should just go into IS1. I already see one of my group members is going to protest what I'm saying, but let me finish and then please. We also talked about whether an example of how an entity might comply with these requirements would be to show that if the item was material, have include more disclosures, and if the item is not material, maybe just include a number. Because, again, immaterial information could be important or could give information to the users. Another comment was made as to whether or not companies should say, make statements as to whether they reviewed items and that those are considered immaterial, and that way the analyst or the user could say, okay, we understand this company has considered this, that is in their mind, and that would give them, that would at least give them some information, but the concern came up again as to whether this would cause more overload than was necessary. Last point I'll make was we looked at the question as to whether we should recommend any other approach, and we didn't really have consensus about that. We talked about some of the preparers wanted to put more information out there on their website, but they were constrained by regulators or auditors looking at that information. And the preparer was saying that they don't like standardization, but there is, on the other side, some of the users we had do like standardization and actually do like an idea of boilerplate to some extent, and they don't always want to see things in the eyes of management. So it was that was an interesting discussion that we had. The last topic that came up was whether the information in interim versus annual financial statements should be the same. So the preparers were saying, well, if we have our annual financial statements plus the and nothing has changed in the interim, then we shouldn't have to give any additional information. The users were saying, well, comparability and consistency is important, so the objective of interim versus annual financial should be the same. So if an item is material in the interim, that would change, that would move the share price, then it should be in the interim. So there was some discussion about that as well, but not necessarily consensus.
Okay. Jane, let's go.
Thanks. The only other thing is under E, where it does get sounds rather prescriptive, or, well, sorry, E2 to 5, instead of just saying sort of how much and inviting a sort of woolly discussion, I can't remember if anybody agreed with me. That should be a bit more prescriptive and should be aimed at Mary was saying understandability. So it's not just how much aggregation or disaggregation. It should say there should be enough disaggregation to make it the information understandable, as opposed to just give us an on one hand on the other, which
sufficiently granular.
Yeah. So this overlaps with a lot of the stuff that came up under the operating segments review.
Okay. Bob?
I think I heard, I was just going to give my personal views, I think I heard somewhat of a consensus on D and then E 2 through 5. And maybe I shouldn't be surprised. I don't know. You know, there's a materiality concept right now. It's kind of ignored in practice. I just look at D and provide specific language E standard that reminds entities how to apply the concept of materiality. I'll be extreme in my statement. Are we that stupid that in each standard you have to remind us how to do it? I'm surprised that comes up. I think there's a general materiality standard right now. We should be more robust in applying it. Now that D tells me you're going to put it in each standard, you know, woohoo, big deal.
I think one thing we did notice that we did discuss in our group whether D and E should be merged and put in one place once is amplification of considerations of materiality rather than repeated in each standard.
And we did discuss standard level versus IS 1.
I'd just say I'm more of a fan of C, but I don't know, my comment is, you know, aren't we professionals? You know, it's just, you know,
yeah, well, it surprises me that this creates problems in practice, but the reality is it really does. It comes up constantly at meetings that we have and conferences we go to. It's a big issue for some people. Saichi?
Thank you. I think one thing missing in this agenda paper is that once something is recognized as material and important, then how to report it or disclose it. I think by and large, we do have the desire that they would be disclosed in the same fashion. So in other words, when some companies disclose the numbers in tabular format, while the others mention it in a narrative sense, many analysts will make up the same table from these narratives. And then there are different types of the tables that the headaches will increase. So I hope that, for example, if you take the option B, 16B, then this example will include the tabular format so that many preparers will use the same one when they are actually material and important.
Kevin?
I know we don't, the ISB doesn't support industry-specific disclosures, but if it's, we had the discussion as to whether the accounting statements, the expectation is the user has some knowledge of the accounting statements. Couldn't that not be expanded when doing disclosure, plus also some knowledge of the industry? Because it can be very frustrating when the preparer is asked questions that don't exist in a particular industry. For example, in mine, gold. Gold is not sold on credit. So when analysts ask questions, where's your trade debtors, it's very frustrating. So it can be put into both knowledge of the accounting and a knowledge of the industry when we're preparing disclosures.
Maybe the profession that needs a little bit of upgrading is the reintroduction of professional judgment into the audit profession.
Yes.
Osman? I think the last part of the question says, would you recommend any other approach? And we responded to FASB discussion paper on the disclosure framework, and we gave that a lot of thought. And as part of that process, we revisited the staff drafts from 2010 on the financial statement presentation. And Saeed, you triggered the thought of the tabular disclosure being very important, because in speaking to our analysts, I think the disclosure volume was a problem when it was in narrative form. Analysts really appreciate tabular disclosure that they can scan through with a lot of confidence, focusing on areas where it looks interesting or looks different, and then look to the narrative explanation. And the concept of having some form of standardization in a tabular form that would kind of give you the roll forwards and the disaggregation would allow users to say, okay, I think I agree with management, these are not important movements, turn the page, move on. Or this looks interesting, I want to either discuss with management more or look to the narrative more. So the volume problem, disclosure volume problem, I think is less of an issue with the tabular disclosure format and the roll forwards. So I think that's my answer to any other approach is that kind of approach.
Marilla?
Like others mentioned, the preparation of disclosures is not only a management decision. I mean, you have the effect of the opinion, auditors' opinion, and even regulators get to affect what is to be disclosed. And when you have an extensive list of options of possible disclosures, well, my fear is that this may be interpreted as a list of a lot of things that need to be disclosed. And even the concept of materiality, I mean, it's hard to apply in practice, not because we can't, as preparers, understand the concept of materiality, but it is not applied only by us. I mean, you may end up having some sort of divergence with the auditors, but at the end of the day, you need to find some balance between what all parties want to have presented in the financial statements. So, relying on the concept of materiality and providing an extensive list of possible disclosures, that doesn't seem like the best option to me, because at the end of the day, you will have an extensive amount of disclosures being provided because of these main interference that you have in the process.
So which of the alternatives in here would do it for you?
I would prefer something less prescriptive and more open for management. Management decision.
So B.
Yeah, probably B.
Bob?
I was a proponent of B. I got more into C, but not picking on what you said, the only point I'm going to make, and it's a high-level point, is we constantly say, are we in a communication exercise or a compliance exercise? And I'll just pick on you is what you said about the auditors and then the regulators is a compliance mindset. It's got compliance written throughout it. And either we go through a communication exercise or we fall into the trap of compliance exercise.
For them, it's risk management. They're managing risk. What is my risk as, for instance, an auditor?
I'll just get basic.
Information.
It's our job to be a communication exercise.
Then you lose communication, exactly.
Communication exercise or compliance exercise?
I'd like to pick up on that. We the users, are the wrong language is coming out. We are being tied to an auditor problem. What they're doing is they've got liability issues, so they want the boilerplate, so they force the whole system into a compliance exercise. This is not a compliance exercise. This is a disclosure exercise, and we're trying to communicate information. We're not trying to make sure that they don't get sued, and they need to exercise professional judgment. And a lot of the problems we're talking about is that the materiality rules aren't being applied correctly. That the auditors, just notwithstanding, they just say, let's go through the checklist. And we need to tie the auditors down and say, wait a minute, you're paid to use some professional judgment, and if it's not material, it's not material. I will put one little plug in. Sometimes the fact that something isn't material is interesting and may be material. We have the oil and the gas example, that if you're the only person, the only company that's not doing hedging in the oil and gas, you know, it might be not, it is material that you tell us that. If you're the only company that doesn't, executives don't have stock-based compensation, you know, it is material from a user point of view to mention that. But that's sort of the exception.
Okay. Jane, then we're going to move on. Although, Mary, you had your card up. Okay.
Yeah, just a quick bit of context, because I sometimes think we're bamboozled by all the people who actually aren't financial analysts saying that, oh, there's so much clutter and it's all so difficult. Most of these annual reports are less than a paperback novel that you could read on the beach in a day. These are large, complex companies. In the back half of the annual report, the number of notes and the complexity is there because they're complicated, and we want to see the stuff. If I was going to, I quite often preface remarks by saying it ain't broke, actually. But anyway, if I was going to cut clutter, I'd do much more from the front half, particularly the way it's done in Europe as opposed to the US, where there's much more scope for spin and brochure speak, which is not helpful. And also, and Russell was mentioning this after our session, that what's it for? And if the front half will be responding to demands from an environmental lobby or CSR and all that sort of stuff, well, so it's now accommodating stuff that's not to do with financial information, it may be to do with risks. So I think we need to be a little bit careful about throwing in the way we react to this. And I completely agree with Bob and Robert that if applying materiality properly would actually solve a lot of the problems in the nitty-gritty part.
Okay, I'm going to draw the conversation to a close. It was very interesting. Alan explained earlier about the steps that we're taking, table one in the paper, the steps that we are going to take in terms of trying to tackle some of the issues of disclosures. And what we were discussing was sort of directly related to that, so I'm sure the note takers will be feeding that into to the various teams that are working on this, and I'm sure we'll be back on this subject in these meetings over the next few years. It's not going to happen straight away.